Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I have the wonderful Beth with me, and she's going to tell us exactly who we're speaking with today. Who are we talking to, Beth?
Yeah, so today we're talking to Ashley Johnson, who is a PhD researcher at Winchester University, and I'm very excited about this. We are talking about Anglo-Norman queens. Welcome, Ashley. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This is very exciting.
You can hear the excitement in Beth's voice, basically. She's bouncing off the walls. This is right up your alley, isn't it, Beth?
It's so up my street. I love medieval queens. It's, yeah, you know, it's nowhere near my kind of personal specialism in history, but it's one of those things that I love reading books about and talking to people about. So, yes, I'm very excited.
Well, why don't you kick us off with the first question, Beth, just because I'm going to be nice.
Oh, thanks, Alina. So before we start, we'll need to kind of set the scene of the Anglo Kingdom at this time. So Ashley, can you tell us a little bit about the key players involved in the period that we're going to be talking about today?
Yeah, so the period that we're looking at today starts in 1066 with William, Duke of Normandy's victory at the Battle of Hastings, where he earns his more famous moniker as William the Conqueror. This victory brings together the Duchy of Normandy and the Kingdom of England into what we know as the Anglo-Norman realm, which lasts through till about, most commonly put, at 1154. In this just under 90-year period, we have four kings: William the Conqueror, his son, William Rufus, William Rufus's brother, Henry I, and Henry I's nephew, Stephen of Blois, four queens: Matilda of Flanders, William the Conqueror's wife, Matilda of Scotland, Henry I's first wife, Adeliza of Louvain, Henry I's second wife, and Matilda of Boulogne, Stephen's wife. I know there's a lot of Matildas, and I have one more because it's also the rather difficult to define figure of the Empress Matilda, Henry I's daughter.
It's like, here's Matilda, 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 and Matilda, and which Matilda are we talking about?
It's the ongoing issue with my thesis, is burning a lot of words specifying which Matilda.
I think you should start just putting Matilda A, B, C, and D. Please refer to index for which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see how the word count goes.
How is your thesis advisor going to allow that? Is that possible? Is that something you can do in your PhD?
That's a good question. At this stage, we are still just calling them by nice full names: Matilda of Flanders, Matilda of Scotland, Matilda of Boulogne, Empress Matilda. And hopefully that can last. It will be the easiest, I think.
I had, so when I did my master's, my PhD is a whole different other kettle of fish, but when I did my master's, my supervisor, however much I love him, he's been on this podcast, and I'm not slating him because he is absolutely fantastic, but every time I talked about someone, he made me put a footnote to explain exactly who I was talking about, because I was writing on Auschwitz, so what the prisoner number was, who the hell was Witold Pilecki, and why am I referring to him? And I hate him because I used up so much of my word count in my footnotes about who I was talking about.
Yeah, there are a couple other Matildas around at the time, not in the Anglo-Norman world, sort of on the continent, and at one point we're like, do we consider talking about them? Because they do sometimes play a part. And we're like, nope, no more Matildas. That's it. I'm done.
Beth, have you got this issue?
Good question. I don't really think so in terms of names. I think it's just them like repeating the same words and phrases over and over. So my master's was on the First World War and the environment, and just the amount of times I'm saying, like, you know, landscape, nature, environment, war, 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 like, you know, you're just saying the same things over and over again, and you're like, I really hope this doesn't, you know, sound so repetitive and boring, but, you know, there's only so many words you can use. But yeah, I know in the medieval period, actually, there's, yeah, so many of the same names.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, but later you move on to Eleanor's, and yeah, I just get the Matildas.
Go on, Beth, you're excited. You ask the next one.
Well, I think we have a part two, I think, of our first question. So we've got this wonderful introduction to our key players, to the Matildas and the Williams and Henrys. But actually, could you just give us a little bit more of a sense of the kind of the state of the kingdom at this time?
Yeah, so with the state of the kingdom, what you're looking at is something that's a little bit new almost. It's not really a tradition to build on, because you've got this new kingdom, which is combining a duchy, or a new realm that's combining a duchy and a kingdom. One thing that is quite prevalent is that this whole area, this whole territory, is being ruled by personal rule. So there's an emphasis on the king and his family as the very head of the socio-political system. Key features of this time do include, there's a lot of succession crises. I don't believe one person inherits smoothly in the whole 90 years. And most importantly, the most pressing issue that they face throughout this time is that it is a kingdom divided physically, and sometimes also politically, but always physically, in that the duchy and the kingdom are on different sides of the channel, which does pose different challenges in terms of rulership, especially when the presence of the king is so vital to that rule.
Right. So we know on this podcast, we've actually developed this quite a lot, where we talk about various different kings and what was actually expected of a king, especially a medieval king. But what was expected of a queen? Sometimes we've touched on this, but other times we haven't really delved into what they were expected to do. Was it this whole idea of kissing babies and having your feet washed and God knows what else, you know, bearing children? Or was there something more to it?
I think there was definitely more to it. What is quite interesting, especially with this period, is we don't have a lot of sources that do tell us what a queen actually was, which, annoying for us as historians nowadays, but did give them the opportunity to, for each an individual queen, to sort of shape the role as they wanted, as they needed, as they were going along. So one thing that is fairly consistent is that traditionally the queen was the wife of the king, and her most important role was giving birth to the next king. Particularly the childbearing part of this was not always the be-all and end-all, but traditionally wife of one king, mother of the next. For this period, so we're talking sort of late 12th century, we have a coronation order from the late 11th, early 12th century, which does say that, does identify the queen as a sharer in royal power. So using sort of that position, that's about as much as we've got. Each queen was able to take on this seemingly quite flexible role, which was shaped by a number of different factors. So the relationship with their husband, the relationship with their subjects, with the demands of the socio-political economic system, all of those sorts of things. So each queen was able to shape the role in a manner of maybe not her choosing, but she definitely had a control over what role she exactly took on.
And you mentioned when we talked about the state of the kingdom, about how there wasn't really this precedent, but being a new dynasty being formed, as to you know how the kings and others should behave. I mean, is there too much of a sense of this for these early queens? I mean, was there kind of, I know we're going to get into some of their characters and experiences later, but can you kind of see a sense of a precedence developing as we've kind of, you know, got a few queens down, and that they're kind of shaping not just their own personal role, but maybe taking certain attributes of predecessors as well?
As we go through the Matildas and Edeliza and through the Anglo-Norman period, I think you do see a little bit of this. My predecessor did this, so I will follow in her path, take her examples, build on that a little bit. Matilda of Flanders, who was the first Anglo-Norman queen, is kind of seen as the first in a lot of ways. She does set the groundwork for a politically active queen that is trying to find a place in what is a new political system. And then going from there, you can see that the subsequent Anglo-Norman queens, and even into the early Plantagenet queens, there is the sense that we set the precedent that we could be involved and we're going to keep that. So with the subsequent Anglo-Norman queens and even into the early Plantagenet queens, you can see they're building on this idea that queens are active, queens are involved, queens are political.
So I want to talk a little bit about their authority in this time period. What kind of authority did they have? Could they set laws? Could they influence their husbands to do something more positive for the community? How much power did they actually have?
So with this question, obviously, the first step is to define power and authority. And that is a big part of my research. Power and authority in and of themselves are very broad concepts. They rely very heavily on the context in which they're being applied. So how I use these terms for my research in this period is that power is the ability to act. It is the ability to make people do things. It's the ability to enact change, those sorts of concepts. It's the very real application of the Queen's actions. Related, authority is along those same lines, but it's about legitimacy. It's the right to act. It's the right to use that power they have. So queens, kings, everyone really in this period has a mix, some of one, none of the other, etc. Some have the right to act, but no power to do so. Some have the ability to act, but no right. So when it comes to queens and authority, it's a little bit of a tug of war almost between her and her husband, and sometimes the leading nobles, as to how much they have the right to do things. A lot of this does come down to how much they need to do things too. But while we don't see queens issuing laws, we have them in physical places of power. So Henry I's first wife, Matilda of Scotland, we have charters that she's issued from the treasury, located in a seat of like a physical representation of the king's power. We have proof that they made judgments on different cases that were heard in front of the king's court when the king wasn't present. They made grants of lands for foundations and markets and all sorts like that. So they didn't take their power. Their power didn't reach right to the top in terms of lawmaking, but they did have power at a lot of different levels through this system.
No, that's so important and useful for us and our listeners to have those distinctions there as we go through the rest of the conversation. And you mentioned earlier about with this being the Anglo-Norman kingdom, obviously there's a lot of interesting perspectives on the events that follow for all of these monarchs and their queens, where, you know, they have this new seat of power in England since William the Conqueror, but then of course the Norman lands. So was there any kind of notion of co-rulership of the nations at this time? Kind of how did it operate?
Oh, absolutely. So co-rulership is this idea of a ruling partnership, and it's most commonly, especially in this period, between the king and his queen. And not always. We do see in this period that the Empress Matilda adopts what can be seen as a co-ruling partnership with her illegitimate half-brother later towards the end. In this co-ruling partnership, there's always different balances of power. So the king is always the dominant partner, but the amount of power that his partner has does change depending on a bunch of different circumstances, including how much power the king is willing to share, need, things like that. Specifically in the Anglo-Norman world, co-rulership was essential. This goes back to some of the points I've mentioned earlier, mainly the idea that this was personal rule and the divided kingdom. Obviously, with two parts of the kingdom on different sides of the channel, the king can't be in two places at once, and he needs a physical embodiment of his rule in the part that he can't be in order to maintain his power and control and authority in that space. And at the end of the day, who really embodies the king better than his wife, who's spiritually and physically tied to him and his power? What we see for most of this period is that in the absence of the king, the queen steps up to fill his space. She's not always fully capable of taking on the entire role. There are still elements of rulership that need the king himself. But while the king's away, the queen is able to take over most of the running in what can be seen as a quasi-regental. They're not fully regents. They don't use that term in the period, but it's a regent-like position, taking over the governance in the absence of the king.
Slightly off topic here, were there any queens that ruled alongside their sons, or, for example, if they had to become queen regent at this time? Is there any of that going on?
So we don't have any surviving documents that indicate any sort of official position of regent or the like. What we can judge off is some of their actions, which is why I use the term quasi-regental, because it's like a regent, but we don't have anything official saying that they are regents. With the absence of William the Conqueror from Normandy, his eldest son and his wife sort of share in managing the duchy in his absence. The most famous example of sort of the involvement of a queen mother in the rule of her son would be Eleanor of Aquitaine, who follows on as the next queen from all of these Anglo-Norman queens, with obviously Richard's absence and the like of that.
And you mentioning sources there actually brings us on quite nicely to our next question. I mean, with the Anglo-Norman queens, what kind of sources will you be studying? Where kind of are there those written resonances of them in the record? I mean, you know, we know for particular periods of history, for quite a lot of periods, you know, it can sometimes be that, you know, women have not been thought important enough to be, you know, documenting their lives and experiences as much as the men. And, you know, here we're talking about ruling kings. You know, as well. So what kind of insights could you give us about that?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the sources from this period is that they don't fully ignore the women in the story or the queens in the story. I think this largely comes down to the fact that these queens were active participants in the events that they are recounting. So it's really quite difficult for them to overlook them entirely, as you find with later periods. This isn't to say that they don't necessarily minimize their involvement or use methods to discredit their actions. For example, there are sources regarding the Empress Matilda who refused to use her name. So we can acknowledge that she's there and we can acknowledge that she's doing things, but we're not going to give her a name sort of thing. We call her a different title that sort of discredits her position.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So they are there. Obviously, as historians, we can't take those at face value, but the fact they are not completely overlooked is quite a telling feature of the narrative sources of this period. So along with the narrative sources, we also have these documentary sources that are representative of these queens' involvement. So we have excerpts from the Domesday Book, which shows that Matilda of Flanders was involved in hearing and settling debates about land ownership. And we also have a number of charters, both that these queens witnessed and that they issued themselves. So the issuing of charters gives us a lot of evidence as to what the queen was involved with herself. And with the charters that they witnessed, we also get the sense of their standing in society. So quite often you'll find that the queen, if she's witnessing with the king present, is the second signatory on the charters, which shows that her high status in society.
we're going to be talking about Matilda, 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 and Matilda.
Yes.
As we do. So we're going to, I'm going to define which Matilda we're talking about. So the original of them was Matilda of Flanders.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about her. Does she do much while she's on the throne alongside William the Conqueror? Or is she kind of just bypassed like some of the others?
Oh, no, definitely. She is a very important figure during William's reign. It's important to note with Matilda, as with her husband, she was the Duchess of Normandy before he conquered England, before she was queen. And so as she was Duchess of Normandy, when he came across the Channel to conquer England, she stayed behind monitoring the duchy in his absence. And this is a position she took for most of his remaining life, or her life. She dies first, actually. She does come to England a couple of times, including in 1068 when she goes through her coronation. She does come to England a couple of times throughout her life, including in 1068 when she is crowned as queen. But by and large, her domain remains Normandy. During this time, she's the head of a council of trusted nobles who manages the duchy during William's frequent and protracted absences. We don't have a lot of evidence in terms of charter evidence for her, mainly because they haven't survived as far as we're aware. But where she is present, she's often present as a witness, including in a number of cases when she was not physically present at the time the charter was created, her signature is added later, which I just think goes to show her relevance to the governance of the kingdom and the duchy. The fact that we are going out of our way to find her agreement, approval for these charters and for what they represent, even though she was not physically present at the time.
And we have to circle back to, you mentioned Matilda earlier as the first Anglo-Norman queen and there being, you know, being the first in that sense and also in others. It'd be really interesting before we get on to the other queens as well. I mean, what kind of particular aspects of Matilda's, you know, queenly authority and her character, what was kind of seen as a, you know, great attributes for others following her to want to emulate?
I think that can be a bit of a hard question to answer because with the sources, we don't necessarily get a lot of personality of these women coming through. Instead, we're sort of relying on their actions. So I think what must have been quite a part of Matilda's life was that she was trustworthy. So I think one of those things was she was a loyal and trustworthy figure on which the king could rely. And I believe that we do see that time and again through the remainder of the Anglo-Norman queens, is that they were partners in like a true sense of the word. They were relied on and they were trusted to take the king's place in a lot of instances.
I mean, she's not the only one that ruled, well, not say ruled alongside a husband, but had some sort of influence. And I'm assuming Adeliza of Louvain, who was Henry the First's second wife, was she just as influential and managed to do as much as Matilda of Flanders?
Funnily enough, she is almost the exception to every other queen of the Anglo-Norman period. And that's because she was married with a very specific agenda, and that was to give Henry an heir. His only legitimate male heir had died in 1120, so the year before they married. And so he had no legitimate male heir to succeed him upon his death. And so he married Adeliza with the key focus of finding a male heir. And I think for this reason, we don't see Adeliza taking a very involved position in terms of governance, because she spends most of her time as queen with Henry in the pursuit of this heir. So we don't see her have the same example of her being left to rule in the king's absence like we do with the remaining Anglo-Norman queens, all of the Matildas. But I think what we can say is that after Henry's death, she does demonstrate that she was capable of being an active and powerful noblewoman. So again, demonstrating that this ability of a queen to be powerful and involved came down to a lot of different circumstances. And in Adeliza's case, the circumstances did not allow this.
And before we move on to our next queen, I just wanted to kind of have a little bit of think about, you know, the ages these women were when they became queens and whether, you know, we know with some of them, they were second wives, had they been married, you know, before, and just like, yeah, how kind of what age they were, and had they, you know, had they had children before, or, you know, how, you know, were they childbearing age when they became queens? What kind of life stage were they all in?
Yeah, so I think what's quite interesting with all of them is less an age question, but definitely the childbearing has an impact on their abilities and their position and their power and authority. So Adeliza is the only one whose entire reign as queen is sort of dominated by this need for a child, this pursuit of a child. With the others, they've either finished bearing children or are soon to finish bearing children in and around their coronation. So Matilda of Flanders is pregnant with her final child at her coronation in 1068. Matilda of Scotland only bears two children, and she does that sort of immediately following her coronation. And Matilda of Boulogne and the Empress Matilda, by the time that they are in a position to start ruling as queens, they are done with their childbearing as well. So I think childbearing across history has always had an impact on a woman's ability to be present and to be involved and to be active in sort of the political sphere. And where the Matildas benefit, while Adeliza does not, in terms of being able to take on a position of power, a position of authority in the governance of the Anglo-Norman realm, is that their childbearing is over quite soon, giving them lots of years as queen to be able to fully invest themselves in a role of power.
Okay, let's move on to the next Matilda. So Matilda, Matilda, Matilda. And we have a civil war in the 12th century. There's anarchy. What was the involvement of Matilda of Boulogne and Second Matilda, Empress Matilda, in all of this?
Yeah, so the civil war comes about because, unfortunately, Adeliza is unsuccessful in having a child with Henry I. She has several with her second husband. But yeah, with Henry I, they don't manage to have any children, which does leave Henry without a legitimate son to succeed him, and ultimately he names his daughter the Empress Matilda as his heir. Following Henry I's death, however, it's not Empress Matilda. Instead, it is his nephew, Stephen of Blois, married to Matilda of Boulogne, who manages to claim the kingdom and the duchy, thereby making Matilda of Boulogne queen. So the civil war is often sometimes referred to as the cousins' war between Empress Matilda and Stephen of Blois, but sometimes it's also called the Matildine War because there is a Matilda on both sides. The conflict comes to a head in 1141 where the Empress Matilda's forces capture Stephen at the Battle of Lincoln, which in many cases, without a commander, the war should be over. But with Stephen, he had again a loyal partner in his wife, Matilda of Boulogne, who takes up the cause in his stead. And so for a period of approximately 9 months, this civil war with its two sides, both sides are headed by a woman, by a Matilda. And so they're very active. They're taking part in the physical conflict. They are negotiating with potential allies. They're involved in all sorts of decisions in order to win this war and claim the throne. The Empress Matilda for herself, but Matilda of Boulogne for her husband.
And we're going to ask you a bit of a thorny question here, Ashley, on Empress Matilda. I mean, can we describe her as the first of England's ruling queens? Because there is this, to put it very simply, a back and forth during the anarchy between her and Stephen, where there are various points where it seems one, you know, might get the edge over the other, and it kind of all comes to a head when eventually there's an agreement that when Stephen dies, Matilda's son becomes Henry II. I mean, can we describe Matilda as an actual queen?
My argument is definitely yes, at least for the 9 months of Stephen's imprisonment, if not for longer. She takes the title of Domina Anglorum rather than Queen. It translates as Lady of the English. It's one of those things where she can't really take the title of Queen because there is a Queen in her cousin, Matilda of Boulogne. But also this title refers back to Æthelflæd, the Lady of the Mercians, who acted in what we would describe as a queenly role, leading the Mercians after the death of her husband. Now, this title is bestowed on her by the Bishop of Winchester, along which time he grants her the crown and tells the people to salute her as their lady and queen. This is a passage from the Gesta Stephani, one of the narrative sources from the period. So in this source, a source that is, as implied by its title, anti-Empress Matilda pro-Stephen, does acknowledge that the Bishop of Winchester labels her as a queen. Furthermore, her actions during this period, she issues coins, she gives out titles, she grants land without any sort of male oversight, also implies that she was acting as a ruling queen. Yet throughout her time in England, she's also issuing coins, giving out titles, giving out land, actions that are usually the domain of the king. I think the Empress Matilda was acting, and I think could be argued that she perceived herself in a way in which she was a ruling monarch. She does occasionally seem to try and transition into the role of a king with debatable success. But yes, she was definitely a ruling monarch, ruling in her own right as her father's intended heir. There are a number of reasons why we argue, or why people argue, that she shouldn't be necessarily seen as a queen. But I think a lot of those reasons aren't issues when it comes to recognizing male heirs as kings. So she wasn't crowned, but you have a number of kings that aren't crowned. She didn't have power over the, or authority over the whole kingdom. I mean, neither did Stephen at this time. A lot of reasons why we believe that she's not a queen don't matter when it comes to recognizing a king as a king or not. And so that, coupled with the fact that we have narrative sources from the time that recognize her as a queen, that her actions at the time are that of a ruling monarch, all go to show that I think she should be considered England's first queen regnant.
I mean, I think you've convinced us, Ashley. I think we're just going to say it.
it's a little passion project of mine, I would say.
No, I completely agree. You know, Matilda, she has to be up there on the list of queens. Like, she absolutely does.
If you're going to, like, to some English heritage, I believe, like cups and stuff that have Queen Jane on them. And I'm like, well, if you're recognizing her as a queen, Matilda should be there too.
Yes, that's always another debate, isn't it, about Lady Jane Grey as well. But exactly, we've got to, you know, if Lady Jane's on there, we've got to have Matilda on there as well. We've got to. And you mentioned that, of course, she was her father, Henry I's heir. And, you know, he made that, like, literally, you know, her older brother had died, and he made it clear that he wanted her to be his heir. And if I'm right, he got his men to swear an oath to her as well. Is that right? Yeah.
Twice over, they swore oaths to that she would be recognized as his heir, provided that Henry had no sons. I believe there was probably the intent that her sons would be old enough to take the throne, or she could take it as like a regent for her sons until they came of age. But I think she wanted it for herself. But in time, that is what came to fruition, obviously, with her fight meaning that when Stephen died, her son got the throne.
No, exactly. And I mean, with these women, I'd say for those of perhaps a kind of a very general interest in medieval queenship or medieval monarchy in general, I guess I'd say Empress Matilda might be the one of those we've discussed that people may have heard of more. With the other women we've talked about, the other Matildas and Adeliza as well, is there one of them that you would, that you would say to people who are listening to the podcast, like, you know, I'd recommend finding out more about her, like she's got a really interesting story, she should be better known, like, do you have a favourite?
I feel like that's kind of like asking a parent their favourite child. I love them all for their own reasons. I think Adeliza at times does deserve more love. I think we often write her off. I mean, she's not a key part of my thesis as well, so I am also guilty of this. But I think because her actions, her power, her authority came later in life when she wasn't a queen, she was just another noblewoman. We often disregard her at times because she wasn't a particularly active queen. But I think in her own way, she has a very exciting story. She manages to find, she's the only Anglo-Norman queen that does become a queen dowager. So she does find her own path there. I think Empress Matilda and Matilda of Bologna are often quite tied together as well, given obviously they're both involved, both trying to rule in their same time period, which is a rather unusual feature, two active queens at one time. No, I don't think I could actually, so after all of that rambling, I don't think I could actually choose a favourite.
I think that's completely fair enough. When, you know, when the historical figures that you study, you know, intensely, you know, it's hard. It's hard to pick favourites. I was just thinking there with you talking about the two Matildas at the time of the anarchy. I mean, I'm surprised, unless I have not heard of one, that there hasn't been a period drama, you know, where it's like Matilda on the one side, Matilda on the other. Like, I can see that being some kind of drama series that would be popular with
I think that would be today. Awesome. I think it definitely deserves to be made into a series.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think, yeah, that would make a great piece of drama, that would. So someone have the idea, please.
Yes, anyone listening, please.
Exactly. Oh, it's been so lovely talking to you, Ashley, about Anglo-Norman queenship. So thank you so much. And how far are you in your PhD at the moment?
So I'm just coming to the end of my second year. So I've got a year to go.
No, we will wish you all the best with that. And anytime you want to come back on the podcast and chat about more of your favourite medieval queens and, you know, or if in the future, you know, hopefully there might be a book in the future or something you might be planning. And yeah, we'd love to hear all about it.
Thank you. I'd love to come back. It's been a lot of fun.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.